Good morning. This is Dawn Ely, and you're listening to Corporate Conversations. And our show today is going to be an interesting show, very informative for business owners, about financing and looking at the financing statements and different ways that you can use your financial data more strategically. But we welcome you to the show, and good morning, Lee.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, thanks. Boy, is it cool weather out there now.
Isn't it funny? The weather changed dramatically in the last week or so.
Overnight. I'm not so sure I'm ready for it. But it's that darkness in the morning all of a sudden
Yeah, that's what you... And it gets dark early. I don't like that either.
No, but we have a good, very informative show here today. And why don't you tell us who our show is sponsored by today?
Sure. Palladium Chief Legal Officers offers highly experienced divisional and general counsel as your in-house CLO at budgetable flat rate fees on a part-time or interim basis. Your company gains the assistance of a dedicated CLO without the cost of having an expensive full-time executive legal employee.
Wonderful. Well, today's show is on using financial information to really manage your business and doing it in a more strategic way. Most companies, I think, are familiar with the traditional financial statements, and the small to mid-sized companies typically, you know, are using traditional accounting software where they produce a balance sheet and an income statement, profit and loss and things like that, and they're trying to manage their business and making decisions based on what they see in those kinds of reports. And, you know, interestingly, as I was doing some research, even as far back as 20 years ago, back in 1990, there was an article published in the Journal of Accountancy that talked about the changing significance of these financial statements and that users are turning to other information sources to meet their needs because these income statements and traditional statements are not providing the kinds of things that they really need in order to make strategic decisions. There's economic changes in the marketplace, certainly, but they've been having difficulty taking a look at business unit profits and loss as opposed to the business as a whole, revenue trends by business unit, and just some cutting and slicing and dicing that they just weren't able to really use out of the traditional accounting software. So we've got a great group of experts here that are going to tell us how they can use their financial data differently than what they may have been able to in the past that might actually reveal a lot more detail about the financial health of their company and make decisions on that, as well as how important that is for companies in the marketplace and financiers and if you wanting to sell your business and get loans, et cetera. So I want to turn to our guests who are much further experts in this than I, certainly. Our first guest is Deborah Pauley. Deborah is a CPA and certified in financial forensics and a certified turnaround professional, and she has extensive experience with companies ranging from entrepreneurial to the Fortune 500. In 97, Ms. Pauley started her company Corporate Financial Solutions to consult with companies in addressing their most pressing financial problems. Prior to starting her consulting firm, Ms. Pauley was controller of Oxford Industries and CFO of the U.S. subsidiary of a German-owned company and was a manager in entrepreneurial services for Arthur Young & Company, now Ernst & Young. Her consulting projects have included transaction services like acquisition due diligence for private equity groups, company integration, cash management for companies in decline, CFO services, and many, many others. Deborah, welcome to our show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Dawn.
So tell us a little bit about your experience here and these types of non-traditional applications that people are looking for, like, you know, being able to break down your business unit costs and expenses. How important is that, and can traditional accounting software that these small to mid-sized businesses are typically using, can you get that information from there?
Well, certainly it depends on the actual software that the company owns or is anticipating purchasing. The key in any software implementation is the actual design relative to your particular business. And so often people don't put enough time and thought into how to design the actual installation of that software relative to their business needs.
Do you think that most companies, especially in the small to mid-size arena where they're probably, most cases, relatively unsophisticated in the financial arena, they may or may not have a full-fledged experienced CFO. They may have a very experienced controller instead. Do you think that they even know what kind of data they want to pull?
Well, I think sometimes they do. I think, and it's not limited to small or medium-sized companies even. People can sometimes be looking at data that's not really for the right purpose, because as companies grow and change, sometimes the data becomes a bit sort of corrupted, yet they're using it the same way. So everybody needs to look at their data relative to their objective and constantly sort of vet it to make sure it really is reflective of the information they're trying to get to.
You know, I can envision a number of companies who start relatively small. They start with a QuickBooks. They start with a bookkeeper. Then they add a line of service. They add a product. They keep adding, and they start, you know, plugging holes, and they just sort of add on top of a structure that may or may not be able to get their needs. And they're probably traditionally looking at, you know, the traditional financial statements of balance sheets and P&L and things like that. At what point do you think that companies need to start looking at additional information to really understand their business financial health? Because could that information, those traditional reports, be misleading if you're continuing to add to your business and growing?
Absolutely. Anytime a business has particularly multiple lines of business, or also what I call business drivers, the things that really drive the profits of the company, those performance indicators are the things that a business really needs to track. Interestingly, I worked with a company. It was a high-growth situation, and what generally happens in many companies is that the financial sort of maybe lag the growth of the business. And so the business had multiple business units, yet was still only reporting in a sort of traditional single-level P&L. In going through to forecast basically cash initially, I broke the company down into its various business units, showed the president how to, in a sense, transfer a price or sell between these business units in order to actually have some transparency and accountability by management. And it was sort of funny. I showed him how all this worked, and he looked at me very seriously and said, "If we do that, everybody's going to know what's going on."
But including yourself, right?
Exactly.
You know, I can envision being a business owner myself. When you start off, and you start off small, and you you think of this whole thing as my business. You know, you don't necessarily think of, you know, this division is this division in and of itself and can be housed and reported on as a single unit versus this one over here and this product and this service line. And, you know, you kind of all roll it up, and it's all profits, it's all losses, it's all costs. And you think, well, this is what my business is. And when it, in fact, you could end up having a side of your business that is horribly unprofitable that's actually dragging down the other side of your business, couldn't you? And not see it.
Absolutely. I think some of the I actually had an accountant on a recent assignment ask me, does it matter where a company is making its money? And it absolutely matters, because the last thing you want to do is have your sort of losing products and services eating away the profitable products and services. You certainly want to get rid of or change those losers and make them into winners. This is incredibly important. This particular project I'm thinking of right now, very large franchisor who had significant infrastructure in overhead in the sort of home office. However, when it rolled up its financial statements for the CEO and for the board, these intercompany charges to the operating units were eliminated and effectively overstated the process of the operating units. It wasn't really clear to the reader the financials of these internal financials where the profit was being made. And I think it was very misleading to themselves. And that's the problem with management reporting, is that you're not sort of misleading an outsider. You're misleading management. Mm-hmm. And that's the worst case it could be in business.
Yeah, because you need to make strategic decisions about where you grow, how you grow, whether you grow in a particular product or service line. And if your reports are showing that you're profitable, you think you've got the cash flow and the ability to expand, when in fact, if you expand, you could destroy yourself if you don't have the right information.
Exactly. A situation I can remember, another large company I was associated with built their overhead calculations based on multiple plants. They went out and bid a contract that would be very specific to one plant. Thought they were going to make a lot of money. As the financials actually came in, they didn't. And so there was a huge meeting as to why this is happening. But they failed to recognize that this one plant's overhead structure differed greatly from this average that they had used in preparing the bidding. So, I mean, I think what happens sometimes is people get, it's sort of the way we've always done it, you know, and they kind of fail to think it all through to the end. And what's the implication of that in the, in whatever that decision process they're in the midst of?
You know, and especially now that we've become a global economy, when people are doing sales and purchases across country border lines, you know, I can imagine that currency issues would have an impact as well that may or may not get caught in a traditional financial statement.
Well, I think they do get caught in the, I mean, they certainly should be captured in a traditional financial statement. I think the question is, how does one recognize that in their business? You know, I've worked for companies with a lot of international transactions, and you know, it that can be, it's up to the business owner to determine, you know, do you want to, you know, buy some forward contracts to cover your commitments, and that's way you protect yourself you know, on any exposure to currency change. So there are a lot of aspects to that. It depends on the type of business.
If you have a business that has a, you know, a significant delay in terms of cost outlaid, whether it's cost of goods sold or some other type of cost, and between when you expend those costs and then recover the revenue from a customer, if you're talking about a three-month time period or more, is it difficult to tie those costs and revenues together in terms of profitability for that particular customer or service?
That's an excellent question, Dawn. People sometimes struggle with that, and they shouldn't have to. But the key to that in most businesses is the managing the cash aspect as well as the profitability aspect of a key customer. This client I'm thinking about right now, they had significant cash flow issues, and their situation was a little opposite of the norm. They got paid in advance, had spent all that money, and yet they hadn't rendered the service yet. Generally what happens, it's sort of the opposite. You render the service and then you collect the cash. So that whole that intersection of profitability and cash management is incredibly important for every manager to understand as in negotiating with a customer, you know, because you've got to manage both of those aspects for a business.
So what type of management information should your reporting include? What kind of reports or metrics should somebody be looking at in their business? And I know it depends on what kind of their business is, but generally speaking, an average product customer, for example, versus a service customer, what kind of metrics would you want to look at when you go into them and see what their real financial health is?
Well, certainly it depends on the business itself. But, you know, whenever possible, you'd want to see profitability by customer and profitability by lines of business. Those are pretty essential. When you evaluate profitability, certainly you can take this to an even more sophisticated level and bring in the cash collection piece of it, the cash management piece. You know, you might have a customer that's very profitable but a very slow pay. Well, if you don't recognize in there the sort of cost of funds aspect of it, then you may not be actually carrying this to the full extent of its profitability. So it depends on the business. I'd say, you know, you want to identify the key business drivers of the business. What makes the business run? And you want to track those drivers to whatever level that you can. And the other piece of it that we really haven't covered yet is the forecasting or budgeting or projection ability of that. You want to be able to forecast your business, and you want to be able to track it against the forecast.
And you pretty much have to have a good picture of historical data before you can do that, though, don't you?
Well, certainly historical data is helpful, but I don't think that should stop anyone from starting mm-hmm. this process. Identify your key business drivers, try to forecast out where you're going to be, and then compare that to build your reporting system so that it matches those drivers and your forecasting, and then track it.
Now, when you say drivers, do you think that companies typically understand as well as they need to what their drivers are for profitability?
I think sometimes people need some education in that. I can think of a situation. I was a private equity group, part of business, and it was a very much custom design build of products, and it included delivery. Well, as we all know, that can be an incredibly cost, expense for a business to deliver a custom product to a customer. Generally, those costs in your sort of typical financial statement are spread into multiple buckets, gas, depreciation on a truck, repairs on a truck, employees who deliver, insurance. And if you don't have a very sophisticated reporting system, that those costs get spread out and, in a sense, buried. Mm-hmm. This private equity group bought a business that had this delivery component. And as I said, I recognize it is a critical issue because delivery was like included. Mm-hmm. So I pulled all those costs together and actually showed it as almost a reduction of sales. This is not GAAP. Mm-hmm. It's managerial reporting. I was trying to show them that whatever you sell it for, the first cost you have is to get it, in a sense, to the customer, reduces your sales price essentially, and then look at your margin. There are different ways of doing this, but you know, the point there was to sort of drive the point home to management that this is a real cost that impacts that selling price directly.
Mm-hmm. So it's, you brought up a really good point of GAAP, the generally accepted accounting principles that are what everybody is required to keep in terms of their official bookkeeping for auditing, tax purposes, etc. Do you see that these one-off or these unique ways of looking at your financial data, are they inconsistent with these generally accepted accounting principle structures, or can you do both in the same system?
Absolutely. You've got to remember that GAAP is meant to be a really for external purposes, so that similar companies are reported somewhat similarly. I said somewhat because within GAAP itself, companies have various approaches that they can take. And again, there's another basis, which is tax basis. Many small companies have maybe a cash basis taxpayer. So managerial reporting should be the thing that really drives the profits of the company. I know personally I've had people say, well, that's not GAAP. Well, yes, that's right. It's not GAAP. But this is what the business, the economic substance of the business is. Now, sometimes GAAP can give you some great guidance on understanding the economic substance. But, you know, I would always look at it as in the sense of what is the economics of this transaction.
Mm-hmm. You know, you've given us a couple of stories of some disastrous results for a company that did not look at these, non-GAAP types of ways of manipulating the data. And I use that term, you know, favorably, manipulating the data to give you good information, not, you know, in a statistics way where you can say whatever you want it to say. But do you find that these profitability by customer, by business lines, are companies typically trying to look at that? Or is, as you said, because it's not traditional GAAP, that they don't even try to look at information in a way that's not, you know, a custom?
No, I think absolutely most businesses have some reporting that's an attempt at identifying those key business drivers. Everybody's got a sales flash report that comes out weekly. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the extent that the a business drills down into those areas of profitability depends upon the sophistication of management and its financial leadership and the ability to pull that data together. You know, one of my concerns, though, is to make sure that whatever data a company is using, that it properly reflects what they're looking for. I have a situation I can think of, another very large company, fairly large company, and I want to emphasize that because this can happen with small companies and large companies. They were publishing a sales report every week, and everything looked rosy. Well, it was a comparable sales report for stores that were open a certain period of time. Well, by the time they went through all these calculations to compute this, the total at the bottom was showed increasing sales from prior period. But the reality was, because of all of these calculations that went on within that report, it failed to consider stores that were closed. So the reality was actually the comparable from 1 year to the next trends were down. Hmm. So it's and candidly, management was surprised about that.
Yeah.
So it's I'd say every once in a while, everybody needs to take a look at their data and sort of question it.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I was doing research on this topic, there are dozens and dozens and probably even hundreds of people out there, companies out there offering these really in-depth management type reporting financial software that would go on top of your accounting system so that you can pull out this kind of data. Is this a system or is doing this something that is in the cash resources of the small to mid-sized company because they don't have the money to be, you know, buying some kind of Oracle or SAP type database? So are there things out there that the small to mid-sized company that has questionable resources, can they afford to put something in place that's going to give them the better information to make better decisions on?
I think it's important for any size company to have data that one, management first and foremost uses. Mm-hmm. Just because people have some sophisticated data available, they're not using it, it doesn't matter. So first, management has to want it, has to see the value in it, and then put in place the the sort of tools to pull it together. Mm-hmm. And again, sometimes with managerial data, you may not have to have it to the point of like bank statement accuracy that you might have to have in GAAP. If, you know, if it directionally tells you which way the company is going. But you need to understand the issues within the numbers in that sense if you're not, you know, kind of getting it to bank statement accuracy. In other words, even a small company can do something within an Excel spreadsheet or some other, you know, method to pull together the right information to help management do a better job.
Okay. And how would a company ensure that they have the right reporting for their needs? What would you recommend they do, or how would they know that they need to start doing something?
Well, if management feels, I mean, first off, good management will know that they don't, that there's more information that they want that they're not getting. Again, it's doesn't matter if the information's there if no one's using it. So that's a sign right there. Another approach, because it's interesting, as I was getting ready to come here today, I thought about something that I do in all of my assignments, and my assignments are very different. He said, I tend to get the financial statements, and I start moving them around, just the basic GAAP financials. Start doing it into business unit or matching similar costs. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to me how many people don't have that in place. Yeah. So, and so there are easy things that can be done. It may be that, and a lot of times a small business starts with a bookkeeper or a young controller who doesn't have a lot of experience. And so they maybe don't see possibilities. So obviously, you know, some choices can be to bring in somebody and, you know, let them take a look at it and say, you know, what do you think? And a lot of times people would go to their CPA firm to do this. And certainly many public accounting firms are quite capable of doing this. But my experience is that if you're not inside a company, if you haven't kind of worked with managerial reporting on a day-to-day basis, I think a lot of times you're not, that's not your focus.
You don't know the right questions to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Probably. Well, does anybody else have a question for Deborah? Well, Deborah, tell us how, what's your target customer? What do you, where do you like to work with customers, and what's your specialty, and how do we reach you?
Well, I work with companies on that managerial side. Although I'm a CPA, that's not what my focus is. It's not in the sort of compliance arena. My focus is to help people improve their business. So I tend to work with businesses that are experiencing some kind of challenge that they can't really handle in-house, that they don't have those resources in-house. I work for generally the corporate stakeholder, the owner or buyer. I do acquisition due diligence, crisis management, and that includes both issues due to decline or possibly some management performance issues. Maybe you have somebody in-house who's not quite doing the job and you don't know which way, you know, maybe you need to go on that. You need somebody sort of on an interim basis to help, you know, determine a correct approach.
Great. So we could suggest that our listeners contact you just to maybe set up some of these reportings where, you know, it wouldn't be a huge big project, but if they're limited in resources and they know they're not getting the information and don't have the expertise in-house, you could come in and take a look at what's going on in the business and just set up the types of reports that would be helpful for them.
Exactly.
So how do we reach you?
You can certainly visit my website. That's www.corpfinsolve.com, or give me a call at 404-625-1348.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for joining us. That was great information. I'd like to turn now to our next guest, Don Brivaldo. Don is a CPA who specializes in M&A and corporate finance advisory services. He's a principal with Walden Businesses, an Atlanta-based M&A firm that is focused on the southeastern U.S. In 2001, he established a practice group within Walden to work on larger privately owned business deals for the smaller end of the middle market than a business brokerage would focus on traditionally. This could equate to a revenue range of $3 million to $100 million, depending upon the industry. And that practice group is called the Walden Middle Market Group. And he is the practice group leader of that organization. And he's also a principal in Walden Businesses. Don, welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Dawn.
Well, we heard a lot from Deborah about some of these non-GAAP, non-traditional ways of cutting and slicing data. And I know that in other types of industries, like if you're trying to get financing or if you're buying the business, the GAAP model does not include a lot of these non-monetary assets and components, such as goodwill, future economic benefits, customer base, managerial skills, and other types of things. When you're working with customers, whether it's trying to get them financing or buying and selling a business, what is your perspective on the reporting that traditionally comes out of these companies, and what do you try, what do you look for, what do you need to really assess that company?
Well, I mean, two different things, traditionally getting financing or considering a sale. There's going to be two different user groups there that might require different things. And traditionally, if we're talking about bank financing, banks, even though times seem to have changed, are still pretty much the same. They want to see historic profitability, and that's usually backed up by good old-fashioned GAAP-based financial statements. And so if they can't check the box and see that for the last 3 to 5 years that people have consistently made money, which is an awfully difficult thing to do in this environment.
Yeah.
Then if you've got a good bank that and a good relationship there, what they're trying to do is look for alternatives to kind of underwrite a financing. And one of those strong categories they're going to look for is a good management team.
Mm-hmm.
And a good management team that has a very sound business plan and has a firm grasp on where they're taking the business. I think this is a very similar thing that buyers are looking for traditionally, unless they're just looking to buy out an existing management team and take it over and run it themselves. And there's a few of those instances, but for the most part, buyers are looking for businesses that have strong management teams. So when we get back to this reporting issue, I think that the management reporting that Deborah referred to, the internal metrics that drive the business, if you're able to demonstrate those in reporting that a business owner and a management team get on a weekly basis or a monthly basis to run their business, and a business owner can produce those reports and show outsiders, financiers, buyers of a business, how they use these reports and how they have command and control of their business, it's ultimately going to help them be more successful in either gaining funding and financing their business going forward or in a sale environment.
So it sounds like you're saying that having these non-traditional management reports actually shows that the management has a little bit more control over their business. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely shows that, both control and understanding mm-hmm. of how their business works. And some of the questions that you asked Deborah, I was sitting there, thinking about how it relates to the target market that we serve. And, we have some, large privately held business clients that are managed very much like small businesses. Mm-hmm. And I think we've all kind of come across those types of clients. And there's nothing wrong with that. But when it comes to doing something as momentous as selling or obtaining outside funding when they've never had any bank debt ever on their business,
mm-hmm.
it changes the game.
Mm-hmm.
And it requires the business owner who's kind of been reactive and just kind of grown up in the business and not really thought, hadn't sat down in an awfully long time and thought intellectually about how the business works, and much less be able to communicate that to an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, these reports, really help the smaller to mid-sized businesses. Maybe a privately held business owner just decides from the very beginning to take a fresh look at the business and introduce some of these additional reports to help them achieve their goals.
When you come in and start working with a client, Do you find that you have to go in and try to introduce some of these different ways of looking at the data so that you can really see the profitability of the company and in different business units and maybe even different locales? You know, maybe they've opened up an office in Alpharetta versus Atlanta, or, you know, in Kennesaw, or, you know, Alabama. And a lot of times they probably don't necessarily look at them as independent units in terms of cost and revenues. What's your experience when you go into these companies?
I mean, we see everything under the sun, as you can imagine. And, you know, that particular question brings to mind, a fairly recent engagement where we went in. It was a family-run business. It had always been that way, second generation running it. Many, many family members in the business. And there happened to be a division that, you know, somebody's cousin, you know, was tapped to run. And, you know, it never made any money. And it was pushed under the rug, and it brought the operation as a whole, the profitability down. So, mm-hmm. You know, how do we find these things out? You know, we're good at rolling up the sleeves and getting in and asking the tough questions. And we have a very good process for our clients that, you know, either our planning clients who are trying to plan an exit or who are trying to plan a funding, where we come in and we study the business with them. And to them, it might be, you know, repetitive, but in many cases, asking these questions prompts them to tell us things, and we pick up on those things and we follow them. So we got onto the story of how the brother-in-law wasn't, you know, doing very well with the business and with the business unit he was tapped to run, and we got to finding out that it had never made any money. And perhaps in a sale environment, what we could do in terms of positioning is to kind of carve out that particular division and show the business, if it didn't have those losses dragging it down, show that it was a much more profitable business. And that's ultimately what we ended up doing.
Now, in that situation, did the business recognize that this division wasn't doing very well, or are they rolling up everything so they really couldn't see it all that clearly?
They didn't recognize it at first, but interestingly enough, we had a good CFO in the business that wasn't a family member. And so,
The CFO recognized it.
The CFO recognized it. He absolutely did. But you've got to understand, he didn't have the voice to talk about it on a day-to-day basis.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So we were in there, and he kind of pulled us aside after one of the meetings and kind of told us, you know, don't let anybody know that this came from me, but here's what I've noticed. And we got into the details and found out that was what was going on.
Because he wasn't producing reports that would show that.
No, not on a daily basis, mm-hmm. actually. You got to understand, a lot of these businesses, mid-sized businesses, are kind of run by the seat of the pants.
Absolutely.
Until this outside catalyst for change comes in, mm-hmm. whether it's my business isn't performing well and I don't know how to fix it, I actually need additional funding when I've never needed additional funding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm 80 years old and I've never thought about an exit plan. Maybe I need to do that now. So these types of things prompt them to get in there and start to think about these things for the first time in many years.
You know, and that's really a shame, because businesses, and we're going to hear from another guest later, businesses can really be so much better performing while they're, you know, before such a catalyst event occurs, that if they could just think about that beforehand and start thinking of some of these questions. So in your mind, you know, we talked a little bit about the benefits of some of these non-GAAP reporting. What have you seen in your environment other than, you know, control? I mean, does it all of a sudden make people realize, oh, my gosh, I can now start doing something different in my business? What value do you see of that in both the financiers and in the business?
Well, for the business owners, I mean, you know, to what how you ended the last question, I mean, we're all creatures of habit, and we get comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So even coming in, let's say we're going to help them raise funding or help them sell, and we uncover this unprofitable business unit. If for some reason the business owner decided not to sell or decided not to raise the funding, you know, many people don't like confrontation, and firing Uncle Larry's son is not an easy thing to do. So what happens, they tend to leave these unprofitable things in there and they cover them back up. That's mm-hmm. just the real world. But, you know, again, if they want to be successful in doing, you know, some of these outside things where external people are going to be actually looking at the business, mm-hmm. and the business owner really wants to achieve a goal, they're going to have to do these very difficult things, mm-hmm. And kind of meet them head on. But, you know, that's just the real world, and that's our experience. I think a lot of times they tend to cover them up. So maybe another alternative to throw in there is the business owner that doesn't want to sell or doesn't want to raise funding but would like to bring in an outside management team to run their business. Mm-hmm. And in that case, they can make somebody else the bad guy. And as Deborah said, you know, when you get a new management team in there, they know what they want to see. They've got to figure out how to get at the data and how to get it on a regular basis. But we've seen many cases where we've sat down, we've talked about exit strategies, and you know what? There wasn't a really good exit strategy, so we're just going to, you know, professionalize and institutionalize the business, and you know, let the business owner go and you know, play golf every day and call in hopefully on a quarterly basis and pick up a dividend check.
So it sounds like the objectives of the business owner is key, and we're going to hear a lot about that from our third guest. But when you go in and you obviously have to deal with what are the objectives of that business owner, if they're trying to get financing or if they're trying to sell, how does that change your actions with that client and how that goes forward?
Well, you know, essentially just have an insight into, you know, the financing process. There's certain things that banks are going to want to see. They're going to want to look for cash flow coverage. They're going to want to look for collateral to back up their loan. They're going to want to look at the character of the management team and their repayment ability. I think it's the five C's of lending. I'm sure I'm going to leave out a couple, and Deborah can chime in. But whereas, you know, a buyer – or, you know, planning to exit your business and you want to achieve a third-party sale, which traditionally can bring you the most money and traditionally can bring the most money with the least risk if it's successful. And I got to underscore that, if it's successful, because not all businesses are sellable to third parties. Those buyers could be looking for many different things. Mm-hmm. I mean, somebody could be looking for a presence in the Southeast to gain entry into a market. A buyer could be looking for access to a particular technology that they could plug into their platform. A buyer could be looking at purely a financial return on their investment. I mean, yeah, who would have thought that? I mean, you would think that every buyer is looking for that, but they all to some extent are, but they can emphasize some of these other things. So, you know, in that process, they're going to be looking for different types of reports. I would make the case that the reports that are going to be required to sell a business are even more complicated than a funding, unless it's a billion-dollar funding up on Wall Street or something. And some of the things, just to mention, you know, some of the key things that we look for, I mean, they're pretty simple and straightforward, but you'd be surprised how many business owners don't have a handle on these things. But immediately, we want to know what the trailing 12 months EBITDA of the business is. And that's earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. And we want to know what this number is after adjusting for perks and Mercedes-Benz and planes and who knows what else is running through a privately held business. Mm-hmm. But you'd be amazed at how many times we come in, we have a new client, and we say, okay, where are we on the last 12 months? What is our EBITDA right now? And they can't answer that question. And they have, for the most part, even QuickBooks can put that report together with a snap. Mm-hmm. But they don't even know that it exists. So we educate them. We know that every investor out there, on a rolling basis, let's say we get a client and 6 months later, at that 6 months in time, they're going to want to know what the last 12 months, because theoretically it represents the most current historical performance of the business on a profitability basis, cash flow basis. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing we look for. Deborah touched on budgeting and forecasting, absolutely critical to selling a business. I mean, the old adage is buyers want to pay for historical performance, but why they're buying the business is the future sustainability of cash flows. And so, you know, value does equal that future value that business represents. If it didn't have a future, even though it had a great past, nobody would want to buy it. Mm-hmm. I mean, the past is the past.
Right.
And so those are a couple of things we look for. And in the last, 3 years, having a, 12-week cash flow forecast is extremely important. And the bankers are going to want to see that.
Mm-hmm. But, it's based on what both you and Deborah are saying, if you can't capture your profitability properly between your costs and your revenue, then you're basing your forecasting on inaccurate information, that forecast is essentially worthless, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And you know, a good buyer picks up on that eventually. And you'd, you know, first off, you'd rather have a sound forecast to begin with that, that can be backed up by the right reporting, and we can demonstrate that that we are actually meeting the expectations in a forecast. What you hate to have happen is for a buyer to make an offer based on that, that forecast, and then we get in 6 months later having spent a whole lot of legal fees and professional time to find out that the forecast really didn't have any merit and didn't have any substantiation.
Yeah, we remember Deborah's example that they thought they were going to be making a lot of money on this contract, and when they didn't, they couldn't figure out why not. Well, they hadn't captured the costs properly. So in your experience, Don, what are the types of what's the impact of poor reporting in your environment?
Oh, wow. We see, you know, pretty much every disaster you can imagine. And, you know, picking up on the forecasting, I recall an engagement a couple years back where we were working with a pretty substantial IT service firm, and they didn't have good budgeting and forecasting in place. They didn't have management tools to monitor their sales force, and I would call it a sales pipeline report that, you know, somebody's looking at on a weekly basis and asking the questions of the salespeople in the field. You know, what type of lead is this? Is it going to turn into a real client? Is are these things really going to back up and drive our forecast? So basically, we did a good job. We ran a process. We got multiple offers for the business. And we found a private equity group that, that took a particular interest in this IT service firm, and they were going to make it a platform acquisition for which they were going to go out and buy much smaller businesses and use their systems and use their management team to actually run a much bigger business that they built over time. Well, you know, again, 6 months later into due diligence, what the buyer, the private equity buyer, found out is that we didn't have any real substantiation for the forecast that we put forth. And I point back to, we didn't really have a system for managing our sales, much less really knowing where our next sale was going to come from. So that was a particular disaster that cost, you know, $10 million or more to a business owner that could have sold their business had we had a real forecast and had we had a real process in place there.
But it took that long to determine that?
It did. We did a good job of kind of hiding that fact, I guess. Yeah. So, and there's multiple other stories. I think, you know, maybe one that I would mention here recently is a business that we're currently working with that is in the telecommunications maintenance space, and they do a good job of maintaining, you know, broadband and fiber networks for folks. And once we got in, we figured out that they did not have good reporting after this surrounding their field labor force. They were using an outside payroll service to do their payroll, and the reports they were getting back were very brief, and when they plugged them in, it was just a debit and a credit, and there was no detail of who was getting paid what and where. And why this mattered is, you know, essentially, as Deborah had mentioned, if you want to track your profitability by job, you and you're a service firm, you got to know where these people are working and how many hours are going to a particular job. So we got in, they became a client, and we found out we didn't have this. Well, what happened? We need it. We need it to run an effective sale process. So what has ended up happening is the owner's having to pay double, you know, the call out the five alarm fire crew to come in and get this information and maybe change payroll services. And it's a real costly process when it has to be done very quickly, but it's a necessary thing that we would need. So, you know, as yet to be determined, we're going to get that information. It's going to help us sell the business. But my point is, if the owner had done some planning and you know, called us, called Deborah, called, you know, their CPA firm earlier and thought about some of the reports they need, then this would have been solved a lot sooner.
In your experience, what are some of the general characteristics of a business that might make it more difficult to get the real financial health out of their traditional financial statements that they might be looking at? You know, multiple sites, multiple product lines. I mean, what are you seeing that in a company can often yield inaccurate or incomplete information from your traditional GAAP reporting?
Well, in, you know, working with a steel manufacturer right now, and what comes to mind is when you're in an inventory-based environment, if you don't have good controls and reporting around inventory, those GAAP-based financial statements can be meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is, you know, you can make your profits whatever you want by, you know, adjusting your inventory number. And, you know, as an old auditor, it's been about 10 years doing that with Arthur Anderson and a local firm called Bennett Thrasher. If that inventory is inaccurate, that's the first place that clients can manipulate the data to their favor, if you know what I mean, especially in a privately held business environment where you want to adjust your profits so that maybe Uncle Sam doesn't have to get as big a check. So what I'm saying is that inventory is something that has to be paid a lot of attention to, especially, again, if you're going to attempt to do something that's going to require outsiders looking over the shoulder. So no matter how you've been treating it for the last, you know, 20 years, 3 years out from a sale or 3 years out from a financing, hey, let's do a proper inventory. Let's make sure that we have a good perpetual system in place and that we have good controls to keep inventory from walking out, and that we, if we've got to pay more tax for the first 3 years, it'll come back to us with a higher sale value and paying capital gains tax rate as a bonus for actually, you know, ponying up and maybe paying a little bit more in taxes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Does anybody else have any questions for Don before we get more information about him?
No, I just would like to comment on this process that Don and people like Don put in place when they're going to sell a business. They're doing, in a sense, a lot of the steps that a buyer is going to do when they get in there. So they're preparing that seller for the sale, and it's an essential part of a successful transaction. And, you know, I just sort of want to commend Don for that type of work that he does. And unfortunately, I know, particularly for Don, since it's a contingency-based process, but he delivers a lot to the table for something like that.
Absolutely. And Deborah makes that possible, too, because we may identify there's a problem, but she's the one that goes and fixes it.
Very good. Well, Don, what is your sweet spot in terms of your business and your customer base, and what can you do for customers, and how can we reach you?
Oh, absolutely. Well, again, at Walden, we're a merger and acquisition firm. We provide sell-side advisory services predominantly to clients throughout the Southeast. Most of our clients are privately held business owners with businesses that range in value from as small as, you know, $3 million in value, and we traditionally work up to around 50 is a good sweet spot to think of us. We're generalist. We like to work in a lot of the different industry groups. I mentioned manufacturing, business services. We have some high tech and healthcare clients, just a little bit under everything under the sun. We're more tied to geography in terms of a client base than anything else, and we have a great process to get up to speed on any type of industry. We also have buy-side services where we'll work with buyers that are out there looking for businesses, and we've got a great system for uncovering things that aren't on the market for sale and helping our clients get some great deals. And we also work with our clients to obtain funding, and we specialize in debt funding, of course, and run a great process to get multiple lenders to put together term sheets and give our owners choices in terms of financing.
Fantastic. So if somebody's out there thinking about possible buy or sell, how do they reach you?
Well, you can give me a call. Our office number is 678-277-9951, my extension 17. My email address or my initials DB at Walden, WaldenBus.com. And you can take a look at our website. I've got some great partners there. We're at WaldenBus.com, and we'd love to help out.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. That's great information and very important for business owners to know if they have a certain objective in their exit strategy that they need to get some stuff together beforehand. Otherwise, it'll cost them more money. And now I'd like to turn to our last guest, who's going to give us a lot more information about that from a firsthand experience. Tyler Tatum is Chief Executive Officer of BrainLike, Inc., a technology company that delivers smart sensing solutions for real-time monitoring applications. His career has been marked by quickly and effectively managing the transition of technology into valuable customer applications. He began his career as programmer with Netuitive, then known as Rapid Clip Neural Systems, in 1997, and he went on to lead that company's programming team as software engineering manager, product manager. And every new market that the company has entered, Tyler took the lead in understanding customer requirements and delivering the best possible solution. And so now he is focusing his strong technical abilities, project management skills, and leadership experience on delivering valuable solutions to satisfied customers very quickly in his new role as CEO of BrainLike. And they have commercial success in defending in the defense and homeland security sector. Tyler holds a BS in computer science from Cornell University. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thank you.
I appreciate you being here. So as a CEO of a technology and service-based company, you've gone through this yourself in terms of not realizing that you did not have the information you really wanted to manage your business the way you wanted to. Tell us a little bit about what you were experiencing and why you realized you weren't satisfied with what you were getting.
Well, our business has been kind of challenging because we've taken a little bit different route than traditional software companies, which we're mainly a software company. We decided, my business partner and I decided not to go after traditional financing to get our company off the ground. And when you take that route, it introduces a lot of challenges, to say the least. What we realized is that in the defense space, we had a lot of potential value we could add to customers in defense because there's a lot of sensor systems used in defense to, you know, find threats and monitor systems. So we decided to go after research and development dollars in the defense market. And going that route, it threw all sorts of new financial management challenges at us because in the defense, well, in government contracting, when you're going after R&D contracts, there's a lot of metrics that for a traditional business you don't really monitor that you have to monitor in order to actually get a contract and to deliver on that contract. You have to track things like overhead and G&A. And the other tricky thing is that our goal has been to build intellectual property that we can deliver to the military and also eventually commercially. And that also imposes a lot of challenges because, for example, if you get a research and development contract with the government and you want to pay for things like patents and even things as simple as interest expense, you can't account for those in your rates. You have to essentially account for that out of profit. Well, that's not – so when you look at the fact that, you know, government contracts, you get maybe 7%, maybe 9% profit on those. That profit is not real profit because once you turn around and look at your cash flows, a lot of that 7% to 9% is going out to your patent attorney and to pay, interest on loans. So it's created a lot of challenges in managing the business on top of the fact that government contracting, once you get a contract, it's a great, you know, cash flow source. The challenge is how long is it going to take to get that contract? We've run into situations where we've gotten contracts in 3 months, and we've run into situations where it took 12 months to get a contract in place. And this is not a multi-million dollar contract, so it's a small business that throws, you know, all sorts of cash flow management challenges at you. And just to talk about reporting, we evolved through our reporting. We use QuickBooks and pretty much Excel. Those are our two main tools. Mm-hmm. Now, those alone don't get you where you need to go. You have to be creative, and you have to have people who know how to use those tools in order to really use them effectively. If you have those resources, you can be really effective with minimal tools in terms of the, you know, your cost outlay. I mean, Excel and QuickBooks will set you back $300, you know,
maybe. Right, yeah. Big investment there.
But your time investment, you know, you're going to have a time investment, so you got to account for someone to manage those financials continuously. And I'll talk about some of the tools we use. The number one tool that I use constantly is Cashflow. I have a Cashflow spreadsheet that I have my bookkeeper office manager maintains religiously. And that is actually not coming out of QuickBooks. What it is we sit down and on a weekly basis, we outline all of our cost, and that can be kind of rough, broken down by vendors, let's say, and who we have to pay, and then we outline all of our income sources. And we take out, 6 to 12 months, and we manage that religiously, because that tells us for the revenue we know we're guaranteed we're going to get, and in this case, I can guarantee my revenue once I get a contract on board. What does my cash look like? And, you know, as a small business, when you're fighting for contracts, that's going to go negative sometimes, mm-hmm. and that's okay. But at least you look at how negative it is and what you need to cover from a cash basis. And I think that's really important because, you know, like both the other guests have said, when you start forecasting, I mean, forecasts, we all know about forecasts. It's all relative. I mean, you may think you got the best. Even like I said, if you have a guaranteed customer, a government customer that says, I'm going to give you this money, it can still take 12 months to get it in the door.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got another 30 to 60 days before you get the money as cash, depending on how long it takes them to pay you. Because you got to start on that contract, then you bill on that contract, and then and it takes 30 days to get the money in-house.
If you're lucky.
Yeah. Well, government's pretty good.
Yeah?
30 days is a really good number in government. Now, the trick with government, I don't want to emphasize this a lot because I know a lot of people aren't government contractors, but the key with government is all your numbers have got to be right. When you send an invoice in, there can't be anything wrong in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because as soon as they pick up on that, they'll kick it back. You got to resubmit, and you got another 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
But if you manage a process religiously, you can pretty much guarantee your money in 30 days. And actually, there's a little trick that we've learned, too. If you offer a discount to the government, even if it's small as 0.5%, they will pay in, say, 10 to 15 days, depending on your discount. We've used that to jumpstart some cash flow at times.
That's interesting. So now, are you do you provide software products, or are you more of a service in terms of your engineers developing IP?
It's our challenge is we're both.
Mm-hmm.
We actually are developing product, and what we tend to go to the government with is we say we have this product, and we can use it to solve your problem. Let us, if you can fund us to build a prototype based on this product. In the government space, the majority of things that actually end up getting used in the field are pseudo-custom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't take a flashlight and sell it to the government and it gets used as a flashlight a lot of times. They'll, add things to it or modify it because the needs are so unique.
Mm-hmm.
So they're used to paying for development and prototypes and things along those lines.
Is that where those $500 hammers come from?
Yes, maybe. Well, that's funny because, the other thing is there's all these other hidden costs that make it so that you end up with a $500 hammer sometimes. And I've talked to folks about that story, and they've said, we told the customer, don't buy a hammer from us. Go to the hardware store,
mm-hmm.
because it's going to cost you $500. I just can't get around it because I have overhead, I have G&A, and I have all these things I have to build on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the customer says, well, I got a contract with you, so I'm going to buy it.
Mm.
So I don't think it's all the vendor's fault or the government's fault. It's you got to realize the system. So
yep, it's a system.
So what type of metrics do you use to track your financials that may not necessarily be your traditional GAAP or right out of QuickBooks kind of thing?
Like I said, cash flow is big. The other things I tend to look at are my rates. So I have had to restructure my entire accounts in QuickBooks, and it looks nothing like a standard P&L. We have G&A as a main cost, and then sub cost under that, and overhead, and then sub cost. And you don't have to do this in order to get government contracts, but it makes it much easier. And so my even if you don't do government contracting, when you go to look at QuickBooks or the standard financial packages, you may find that the way that the account structure is typically outlined doesn't fit your needs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay if your P&L and your balance sheet don't look like a normal P&L and balance sheet if it helps you manage your business.
Right.
The way I have my P&L right now, I can produce a P&L, throw it in a spreadsheet, and change a couple numbers, and I can get my rates.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally, the people, as far as I understand it, a lot of other businesses who don't do that, they take their standard P&L, and then they transfer manually those costs over to all your buckets
mm-hmm.
for your government rates, for example. And that's a painful process, and every time you start transferring numbers, you know, there's errors.
Well, and so, as we heard from Deborah, one of her clients didn't do their cost allocation properly and found out they were actually losing money on a bid instead
yes.
instead of gaining money, which is very important to know.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think it's another good point to make here is even though you're on a small system like QuickBooks, you can have a number of formats available to you that you can run that same database of numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So he can have a more traditional GAAP-based financials as well as managerial statements. And certainly as you move up into more sophisticated software, there's the possibilities are practically endless.
I'll mention too on QuickBooks is I ran a business before this that was heavily inventory-based.
Mm-hmm.
We intended to produce and sell about 130,000 pieces at a time of, it was actually the literature you see in the hotel rooms that invites you to reuse your linens and towels. We were the main provider of that, Project Planet. And that business was interesting because it wasn't technology at all. I followed my environmental passions for a while, but I used so much of my technology background because when you're managing inventory in situations like that, I essentially had to dump all of the data out of QuickBooks into an Access database and write queries to pull the data out in different ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, the things I wanted were, what's my average sale per customer?
Mm-hmm.
How much of each piece am I selling on a monthly basis? And a lot of those metrics I would turn around and use to estimate inventory. Because when I would do a print run for those things, I was printing, say, 11 up on a sheet or so. And so I had to know, and I'm producing, say, 10,000 sheets, or it was 13 pieces on a sheet and about 10,000 pieces at a time. So you got to know, do I really want 10,000 of that particular item? Am I going to sell it in the next year or 10 years? Where some other items I may want to double up or triple up on. So again, you can work with minimal tools, but you have to have the resources to do it and the talent to do it on the IT side because small businesses, if they're run well, can be incredibly IT intensive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because being a relatively smaller to mid-sized company in volume, you know, your statistics generally don't mean a whole lot because you don't have enough to sort of average out. So what would you advise C-level management to do and what questions to ask themselves to determine how they want to measure their metrics for their business?
Yeah, that can definitely be challenging. Like you talked about breaking down your business lines. Well, with us, you know, to date, it's been challenging to do that because most of our, you know, we have very few customers right now and we're getting most of our revenue from those. And you know, sometimes we take a job and we know it's not the best thing for the long term of the company, but it's best thing for the short term cash flow. So, but a lot of the questions I wanted to bring up that I think are really important when you're going into figuring out what you want to do in terms of financial management are simple questions. What type of business do you really want to be? I mean, do you want to be a cash flow family run company, and in combination with what's your exit strategy? Do you ever really want to sell the business? If you don't want to sell the business, you can waste a lot of time, you know, no offense, but, you know, creating certain reports and you know, doing certain levels of financial management that you could be spending on sales because in a small business, even mid-sized business, sales is king. I mean, you got to sell. So you can waste a lot of time on things that aren't really important to where you want to go with the business. And
you just want to use it as a cash flow, you know, king, you know,
yeah,
cash cow.
I want to pay my bill. You know, I want to have a nice lifestyle.
Yeah.
And like both of the other guests have talked about, if you do go to sell, you better realize that you're going to be in, it's going to take time to dig in and figure out what is really in the business when you do go to sell. Because I've been in situations like my last business, I was looking to potentially buy it out from the current partner. And part of the challenge was, how do I really value this business and how does he value it? And can we come to common ground on that? It's not a simple thing to do depending on how the business is run. And a lot of times I've been in, you know, two different businesses with partnerships. And for example, one of the things I do is I come in and I say, all right, no perks. If we're going to run this business, we're going to run it like an asset and we'll take a salary. And if you can pay for what you need to out of that salary, great. If you can't, pay for it out of profits, but we got to get the profits up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you talked about, I mean, if you run a lot of expenses through the company and you eventually want it to be valued by someone else, they have to strip all that out and it's not clear. So I think, now then again, if that's the style of business you want to run, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, take it and use it as to your best advantage. But I just find that, and I have a lot, I interact with a lot of business owners who are friends and colleagues. And so I have these conversations a lot, and I find that's really important. You know, like a person I was talking to who I was giving some advice to, he's starting up an architectural firm on his own. And, you know, in that situation, you got to kind of look at yourself and say, do I want to be a 10-person architectural firm and do, you know, a good amount of business every year, but it's kind of going to be my baby? Or do I want to be a 100-person, 200-person, the sky's the limit firm? And if that's the case, you want to do a lot of the things up front that both the guests have been talking about so that as you grow, you can manage that growth.
Mm-hmm.
So...
very, very important and key topics to consider. Does anybody have any questions for Tyler? Well, Tyler, tell us a little bit more about your business. It sounds really fascinating. And how can people find out more about it? Are you only government contracting, or what are you doing?
Our business, like she said in the beginning, and I'll elaborate a little, we essentially have a process that we're applying to various sensor systems, and the easiest one to think about that we've actually are building a product around right now is commercial surveillance application. So you have a video camera, and you're getting data from that video camera to obviously monitor your property or monitor equipment. One of the biggest challenges is how do you reduce that data? Because right now, it's on the verge of being unmanageable in terms of the amount of data that's being collected, but the sensors are getting better and better. So they're going from, you know, sensors that are creating 10 megabytes per second worth of data to, I mean, soon enough, it'll be, you know, maybe close to 100 megabytes per second coming out of these cameras. We have software that's able to identify events of interest in real time at or near the camera that can essentially reduce your data that flows from there down to the rest of the system.
Hmm.
So that's our real smarts.
So this could be used by large retail outlets that have, you know, security monitoring, et cetera?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And we're actually building a product that would work with any situation where you have a surveillance camera and you want to more efficiently manage your overall data flow.
Great, great.
The camera, so.
Well, how do people reach you if they want to inquire about your product and services?
My email address is Tyler Tatum, TylerTatum, at brainlike.com, BrainLike.com. And you can always reach me at my phone number, which is 404-783-0923.
Great. Well, I've really learned a tremendous amount here from our guests. And for the benefit of our listeners, if you're a company that basically has anything other than one product or one service that you sell, you know, you probably could use some different types of reporting other than your standard financials of balance sheet, asset, and P&L. You know, for example, if you do custom work, if you have inventory, if you have multiple sites, if you have multiple product or service lines, if you have an extended time between outlay of costs and receipt of revenues for a job or a customer or a product sale, and if you want to look at your sale or profitability per customer, per vendor, you know, these are all reasons why you want to set up something outside of your standard reporting. And definitely contact our guests to find out how you can do that. So very good. Lee, why don't you tell us again who our sponsor was?
Sure. Palladium CLO brings to your business in-depth knowledge of your industry, of the players in your industry, their businesses, and how the various legal and business issues affect your industry and your business. Palladium sees the possibilities, not just the liabilities. You can find out more information at www.palladiumclos.com.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us on Corporate Conversations. Next week, our show will be on non-competes. And the conventional wisdom by most business owners is that they're not enforceable, but they are. So join us and hear how you need to structure them for next week's show on Corporate Conversations. I'm Dawn Ely, and we'll see you next week. Thank you.